and gentlemen, welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have one matter on the 2:30 docket this afternoon, and that's Ward Churchill against the University of Colorado. Council are aware, no doubt. We've read the briefs, we've reviewed the record, and so if that helps in streamlining your presentation, so be it. You have 20 minutes per side for argument today, and the yellow light still comes on, I believe, with 5 minutes left, so you can plan rebuttal around that. I would ask the ladies and gentlemen in the audience to please turn off pagers and telephones so that we can not be interrupted during the course of the argument. Counsel, you may begin.
May it please court, counsel, my name is David Lane. I'm here representing the plaintiff appellant in this case, Ward Churchill, who is before the court with me at counsel table, are Tom Carberry and Anthony Noble. I just have to start by saying that there are very few cases that in the career of a lawyer, and likely in the career of most judges, that have the ability to define the legal landscape beyond the individual case that is before the court. This is one of those cases. This case has ramifications that go far beyond the bounds of this courtroom or this case. This has national significance, and it has national significance for a very good reason, and that is that you may not have an answer in this case, but you may, and you may certainly have the best shot at defining the legal landscape that anyone in this country looks at, because rarely has there been a juxtaposition of First Amendment issues and academic freedom that this case presents. This court obviously is familiar with the record. I'm not going to belabor that. I am going to touch on various aspects of it. And I'm going to start by asking the court to focus on the issue that is perhaps the least difficult issue. It was the first issue in our brief, and that is the issue of the bad faith investigation as a freestanding First Amendment violation claim.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. Lane. If we determine that the Regents and the university are immune from a 1983 claim, why do we need to consider the claim that the investigation constituted an adverse employment action?
Well, as this court knows, all of the case law defining quasi-judicial immunity talks about the function, not the title imposed upon the person seeking immunity. There has not been any argument raised by the University of Colorado, nor ruled upon by the court below, that when they launched the investigation against Professor Churchill, there was even any pretense of acting in a judicial capacity. The record in this case is absolutely crystal clear that it was all but a torchlight parade led to the front steps of Regent Hall at the University of Colorado. And the regents at the meeting where the investigation was launched were falling all over each other to grab the microphone, not acting in a judicial capacity, quasi-judicial capacity. They were acting as politicians, being politicians, falling all over themselves to blast Ward Churchill's comments to the national media that was assembled at that meeting, and calling for his dismissal. Chancellor DeStefano said that he would launch and oversee a thorough examination of Professor Churchill's writings, speeches, tape recordings, and other works. The purpose of this internal review is to determine whether Professor Churchill may have overstepped his bounds as a faculty member, showing cause for dismissal as outlined in the laws of the regents.
Mr. Lane, just for a moment, taking the political and bias aspect out of it, if the Board of Regents were to order an investigation, would that qualify as a judicial function, or would it be something else?
No, it would be something else. That is completely out of the realm of any judicial action. This is simply, Clevenger is the lead case on point in terms of quasi-judicial immunity. It wasn't even cited by CU in their brief. The lead case from the U.S. Supreme Court was not mentioned once for a reason, because it doesn't help them. But Clevenger says and directs this court that reality has to intrude into the decision-making process here. You are required by the terms of Clevenger to look at the reality of the situation and not some hypothetical, well, maybe some Board of Regents could be acting in a quasi-judicial capacity if they launch an investigation. You have to look at what this Board of Regents did. And the comments made by the regents at that meeting were they publicly apologized to the nation on behalf of the University of Colorado for the comments made by Professor Churchill. They called him reprehensible. He was an embarrassment to the University of Colorado. These are not done in any kind of a judicial capacity. These are done in a political capacity, and that's what launched the investigation.
Can I ask what your definition would be of an adverse employment action?
Absolutely. The issue in this particular case is a bad faith investigation and adverse employment action. And we, along with the amici that wrote excellent briefs, in my opinion, cite to the Garcetti, the Pickering-Garcetti test, which defines whether or not a First Amendment violation exists. And clearly, in this particular case, Garcetti requires that you determine whether the speech in question was done pursuant to official duty. The answer is no, it was not. It was an article written for an online publication. So Garcetti's out of this mix. Is it a matter of public concern? Clearly, he was commenting on 9/11. Is there a governmental interest in efficiency which outweighs freedom of speech? The answer to that has never been yes by CU. CU has never defended on that ground. Did the speech motivate an adverse employment action? The jury ultimately concluded, yes, they fired him because of his speech. And would the adverse action have happened but for the speech? The jury said no.
I think I must not have made the question clear. I wasn't really asking what would be, what would constitute a First Amendment type of retaliation. I was thinking more in terms of, we think of an adverse employment action as being termination or some effect on employment. And so I know that there's been some debate in the briefs back and forth about whether an investigation would qualify. And I was wondering in that context, what is your definition that would cause investigation to qualify?
An adverse employment action is defined as any action which would deter a person of ordinary firmness from speaking. Did they take an action which would deter a person of ordinary firmness from speaking out? The answer is absolutely yes. And on page 3 of our reply brief, we cite to numerous cases from all over the country that define a bad faith investigation as an adverse employment action. We have out of the 10th Circuit, Royal versus Henry, which specifically names a bad faith investigation is an adverse employment action. Not that the 10th Circuit controls this court, but it is relevant because we are in the 10th Circuit. Initiation of an administrative inquiry against a custom employee, the 9th Circuit found to be an adverse employment action. There was an unwarranted disciplinary action that both the 9th and the 7th Circuits found to be adverse employment actions. They're cited in the brief on page 3 of the reply. There was a hospital investigation of a doctor. The 9th Circuit found that to be an adverse employment action. The most important case directly on point is Levin versus Harrelson, which is a Second Circuit case where a university professor was on the receiving end of an ad hoc committee which was investigating the professor's speech. And the Second Circuit found that that mere investigation was actionable as a First Amendment violation.
So distilling it down to the essence, you would say it would have to have a bad faith type of motive,
yes,
and that it would have to be of such a nature as to deter a reasonable person from exercising First Amendment rights.
Absolutely.
Mr. Lane, taking a look at the complaint that was filed on Mr. Churchill's behalf and then the trial management order under which the claims were tried, the second claim for relief alleged that defendants' acts of intimidating, threatening, and investigating, and finally terminating Mr. Churchill were improperly motivated and unconstitutional and First Amendment violations. So investigation was included in the second claim for relief. The first claim for relief is identical to the second claim for relief, except for three words, as far as I can tell. The second claim for relief is identical to the first, except it adds the words, and finally terminating. So why wasn't it perfectly okay for the trial court judge under Colorado law and federal law to say that the two claims were duplicative and just dismiss the first claim for relief on the fact that it was duplicative.
I don't believe that's what the trial judge did say.
Yes, but why can't we affirm on that basis?
Well, because that's not what happened.
It doesn't matter, does it? We can affirm on any basis, can't we?
Well, you can, I suppose, but the issue before this court, and as framed at the trial, is there were two claims for relief. One was the bad faith investigation. The two claims were not identical. And in fact, the first claim was specifically pled as, in the factual affirmance of the complaint, that this bad faith investigation is a freestanding First Amendment violation.
I'm reading your complaint. It does not say that.
I'm simply saying the way this case was litigated, I don't have the trial management order in front of me, but...
And the complaint is identical, by the way, to the trial management order.
But the way this case was litigated by all parties, including the court, was two claims. One is the bad faith investigation, and I believe I don't have the complaint in front of me either, but if I recall it correctly, the complaint, I didn't simply draft a complaint and said the same thing in two counts. I didn't do that. And I think it can be fairly read that the first claim involves a bad faith investigation. The second claim does not necessarily involve the bad faith investigation. The second claim is the termination. That is how we proceeded to trial. That's how the defendants proceeded to trial. That's how everyone proceeded in this entire case.
But you put on evidence in the course of proving your second claim for relief that the investigation was done in bad faith, didn't you?
We didn't parse it out in terms of now we're dealing with this claim, now we're dealing with that claim. It was a chronological presentation to a jury where we started with the torchlight parade to Regent Hall and we ended with the termination of Professor Churchill. And chronologically, the bad faith investigation took up a considerable amount of the trial time. And then we moved into after the investigation concluded, we moved into the Scrum Committee's findings and the P&T Committee's findings. So no, they were discrete, they were separate claims, they are not duplicative of one another. The trial court said in dismissing, he didn't say these are duplicative claims, he said a freestanding claim of a bad faith investigation is not in and of itself a claim that is cognizable under the law. And that's what we have appealed. It's that ruling. And it is not, the court is in error when the court said that. A freestanding bad faith investigation claim is cognizable under the law of every circuit that has found it. There may be factual circumstances where it's not done in bad faith, but in this case it was done in bad faith. We never got a chance to show that to a jury. That has nothing to do with quasi-judicial immunity. That should have gone to the jury. And the jury should have been able to determine whether or not, in fact, that was a First Amendment violation and whether it was an adverse employment action.
Attorney Lane?
Yes.
Would you switch gears with me for a moment or change lanes and talk a bit about...
Got to be myself, but go ahead.
And talk a bit about Rule 106. And the question I have for you is this. Is an action by an independent body corporate in Colorado necessarily reviewable only under 106A?
Only if you buy into the defendant's argument that they have judicial immunity. If they have full immunity, then that is the only review that is available, which is an absolutely insufficient remedy. As you well know, the standard for 106 is basically abuse of discretion. Is there any evidence anywhere in the record that could possibly support the finding of the judicial actor below? That is hardly de novo review. What we have here is a claim of quasi-judicial immunity where the regents are asking to be completely immunized. The only review would be an abuse of discretion standard. There is no ability for judges such as yourself to define the First Amendment, to define the Constitution of the United States. They want you to lose the ability to look at the Constitution and tell them that they have violated it. And Cleaver sets forth the test for determining whether that occurs.
Well, doesn't Butts set forth a test?
Butts
and Cleaver. And Cleaver really doesn't apply all the factors in Butts, does it?
I think Cleaver gives more factors than Butts gave, actually. But when you look at the factors, you have to keep in mind, again, under Clevenger, the reality of the situation. CU has existed for over 100 years with qualified immunity protecting them from frivolous lawsuits. And now, all of a sudden, after 100 years, they come into this courtroom and ask for full immunity from lawsuit. And they do that on the heels of losing a trial. There is no reason CU could not have said to Judge Naves, rule on the quasi-judicial immunity issue, save everybody the trouble of 6 months of prep time and a month of trial, and tell us, are we immune? They didn't do that. They wanted the trial. They wanted to take this to trial, presumably because they thought they were going to win. And when they didn't win, they come in and say, we need immunity because the sky is falling. What happens if we make decisions like this and everybody sues us? And the answer is, in 100 years, that hasn't happened. That hasn't been the case. Is there some compelling need for quasi-judicial immunity to the regents of the University of Colorado when they themselves insisted on going to trial in this case? When all they had to do was ask for an immunity ruling pre-trial and they didn't? You know, can they perform their functions without harassment or intimidation? That's the first Clevenger test. Here, Churchill was the guy who was being harassed and intimidated. CU was reveling in it. They were taking action for the public's consumption.
Well, doesn't the trier of the issue, isn't that the person who has to perform functions without harassment?
And
here, you've got a board under the Constitution who can fire this president if they want to, under Article 7 or Article 9, Section 13. So there's no danger that the board here is going to be harassed or intimidated, is there?
The Board of Regents?
Yes.
No, I don't think there is any danger that they're going to be harassed.
And the question is whether they're entitled to quasi-judicial immunity.
And I'm saying not only are they not the ones that are being harassed here, it was Churchill that was being harassed. And that was recognized in Moore versus Gunnison Valley Hospital, that it goes the flip side. A lot of times it's the person who gets fired that is on the receiving end of the harassment and intimidation. Another key to quasi-judicial immunity is insulation from political influence. This is a sham due process proceeding that CU put them through. The head of the investigating committee had written an email that was never disclosed to us. We found it independently, where she referred to Ward Churchill as she compared him to O.J. Simpson, Michael Jackson as a child molester, Bob Guccione, a pornographer, and Bill Clinton, a philanderer. This is not an independent investigation. This is very similar to Clevenger, where people who are not full-time ALJs, who should be given immunity, these are people who are appointed by the regents to do their bidding, and they did. When you have, are you acting in a judicial capacity, if any one of you had made the statements about Ward Churchill that anybody on the Board of Regents had made pre-adjudication, you would have been recused immediately. You can't say that acting in a quasi-judicial capacity. I have about 3 minutes left, and I think I'm going to reserve that. Thank
All right,
you.
Mr. Lang.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Patrick O'Rourke. I'm appearing on behalf of the Regents of the University of Colorado. With me today is Carrie Hershey, who was my co-counsel during the course of the trial. There's really been three issues that have been raised for the court's consideration. Two of them are legal questions. One of them is a factual question regarding Professor Churchill's reinstatement. I'd like to address the investigation piece first, and I'd like to address that in trying to draw a distinction that hasn't been brought out very well. Investigation was addressed by the United States Supreme Court most recently in the Burlington Northern case, and that was a case that arose under Title VII, in which the court looked at a claim brought by an employee and considered the issue of whether or not action short of termination could be actionable as retaliation. And they said, yes, that's possible. There's two of them in this case. The first one would be that demoting an employee to another position where they had less favorable job duties could be one. And the second and more important one is they said that a suspension without pay during an investigation could be an adverse employment action. And what they latched onto there was the fact that the employee had been suspended without pay and the consequence that had upon the employee. What they didn't say is that an investigation in and of itself is an adverse employment action. And then that translated down to the 10th Circuit's next consideration of the issue in the Couch case. And in the Couch case, the 10th Circuit looked at the law from around the country and found that investigations generally are not adverse employment actions. And you can raise the question of, well, what is that generally there for? The generally is therefore to respond to the case that Mr. Lane cited, which is Worrell versus Henry. And in that case, there was evidence of a bad faith criminal investigation and prosecution. And the court in that case said that employing that type of criminal machinery could be actionable under the First Amendment. What the courts have not done is they have not said that employers are unable to investigate workplace misconduct. And in this case, there were two different investigations, both of which were absolutely appropriate under the First Amendment. The first was the ad hoc investigation that was done by the chancellor after the Board of Regents meeting. At that point in time, the chancellor said, I'm going to conduct an investigation to determine whether or not Professor Churchill's speech is outside the boundaries of First Amendment protection. And the reason that's appropriate is that under the case law, starting with Waters versus Churchill, carrying through to the Enquist case and the Anderson versus McCotter case, is that a public employer has a right to take action against an employee for otherwise protected speech when that impairs the employer's interest in the workplace. The only case that has addressed this, to my knowledge, is the Heil versus Santoro case that came out of the Second Circuit. And what they said is, in light of the employer's obligation to conduct an investigation before disciplining the employee for First Amendment otherwise protected conduct, you have to investigate. And therefore, there's no way that an investigation itself can become an adverse employment action in this context.
Mr. O'Rourke, let me just ask about that. So are you trying to draw a bright line that if it's an investigation that falls short of a bad faith investigation that results in criminal prosecution, that it's not an adverse employment action?
Yes, I believe that that's accurate.
What if it's just bad faith that affects the person's employment?
Well, if it's bad faith, then it has to affect the person's employment. And what I am suggesting to you, Judge, is that what the courts look at is not whether or not an investigation has been conducted. It's whether or not there's actually some adverse action that stems from that, whether the employee is demoted, suspended, terminated, taken away their vacation days.
What about loss of reputation?
I don't believe that that's actionable, Your Honor, because there's a body of law out of the 10th Circuit that says that things like unflattering memos that get put into the file, hurt feelings, those type of things are too intangible to in and of themselves constitute adverse employment action.
Okay.
What about losing speaking engagements or getting put on a different tenure roster or treated differently from other professors?
Well, there was no evidence that any action taken by the university was of that character. Professor Churchill remained a fully tenured professor. He didn't lose any rank. He didn't lose any duties. As far as speaking engagements go, what you would be talking about then is making the university liable for actions taken by other parties. If someone else chooses to cancel a speaking engagement for Professor Churchill, we don't know, and there was no evidence presented as to whether or not that was a result of the university's investigation or the other publicity that was generated in this case. Mr. Lane has talked about the nationwide publicity. I'd be willing to venture that it was more likely the fact that Professor Churchill was the subject of that media scrutiny that led to his other speaking engagements outside the university being canceled. But nothing under 1983 allows you to hold the university liable for actions taken by another based upon what they perceive to be the benefits or detriments of having Professor Churchill speak to them.
Okay, for example, I'm just trying to see where the limits are. Let's say that you had a different context, a doctor who was being investigated in bad faith by some sort of board of licensure, and it was made public to the extent that people lost faith in his skills and he lost, no one would come in and use him as a doctor. In your thought, that would qualify?
Well, and I actually think that that's very similar to what the 10th Circuit's holding was in the Couch case. If you go back and review that, that's the 10th Circuit's most recent case that deals with the issue of bad faith investigation and whether or not that can be an adverse employment action. And in that case, the doctor was not only investigated for Medicare and Medicaid type of fraud, was asked to do a psychiatric evaluation, and his reputation was being tainted. But the court looked at it and said investigations of this type are not adverse employment actions. And tellingly, they said that in the hospital setting, it is part and parcel of a hospital to be concerned about billing fraud, to be concerned about that. And in a highly regulated industry, their language was, it can hardly be considered adverse action for it to investigate things that affect its reputation and its integrity. So that if you apply that in this case, when you get into allegations of research misconduct, they are exactly the lifeblood of a university, and we have an obligation to investigate those. And that is not adverse action because professors should be able to defend the merits of their scholarship.
Okay, so just trying to see how it links up with this case, your position would be that the investigation, to the extent that it was taken in bad faith or not, didn't sufficiently affect the employment to constitute an adverse employment action? There was no sufficient link affecting employment?
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the reason that's so is that it's the exact same thing they talked about in the Couch case, that once you get past the can we investigate on the First Amendment arm to determine whether or not this is protected conduct, then you also look at the investigation of the research, and the question is whether or not that would show a person of ordinary firmness. In the scholarship setting, scholars are expected to be able to defend their scholarship. If somebody says to you, what is the source for this claim? Did you plagiarize this? Those are routine academic inquiries. And if you have standards for investigation, as the university does, that says an honest error does not constitute research misconduct, that difference of opinion does not constitute research misconduct, that different interpretations of data don't constitute research misconduct. What it says, the research misconduct policies, is only intentional violation of standards of academic scholarship constitute research misconduct. And there was no evidence presented that that would chill a person of ordinary firmness from exercising their First Amendment rights. All scholars expect their scholarship to be challengeable, and when they are challenged, they should be able to produce the reports.
Regardless of motive?
Yes. Absolutely. Because what you're going to run into is a situation then where you have effectively handcuffed universities or other employers from investigating into conduct because they will face a retaliation claim every time that there is something affecting an employee. They will come and say, the employee will say, I've spoken, I've been controversial, you can't investigate me, and if you do, I'm going to push this case through to suit. Unless that actually goes and generates a true adverse employment action, where you lose a benefit employment, where you lose privileges, where you lose something tangible, the courts have not been willing to handcuff employers in that way by saying, you don't have a right to determine whether or not your workplace standards were violated. If something bad happens, ultimately, to the employee, that is actionable. And it's exactly like Judge Terry was talking about earlier, that Professor Churchill brought a claim, presented the evidence that the jury got to consider, that the university engaged in action, had an investigation that resulted in the termination of his employment. And that is the adverse employment action that should be actionable in this case.
What about selective treatment, born of ill motive, chilling the free speech rights of other people?
Two things are relevant to that inquiry, Your Honor. First, that this was never pled as a selective enforcement case, and there, in fact, was not evidence to support a selective enforcement theory. In fact, that was one of the issues that was explicitly considered by the P&T committee, is whether or not the university enforced its standards of scholarship selectively against Professor Churchill, and it determined that he did not. More importantly, beyond the fact that that wasn't the theory on which the case was pled, or that it was prosecuted, you have the fact that, pardon me, I've lost my own train of thought for 1 second. Can I hear your question back one more time?
My question goes to selectively investigating someone on the basis of an ill motive, chilling the free speech rights of other people.
Thank you. That was my second piece, which is not only is there any evidence of selective enforcement, and it wasn't called selective enforcement, but on the chilling issue, is Judge Mays made a specific factual finding that there had been no credible evidence presented by anyone that this chilled speech at the University of Colorado. And in fact, during the reinstatement hearing, Professor Churchill's most ardent supporters, Professor Mayer, Professor LeCompte, and Professor Perez, all testified, no, there has been no adverse action taken against me. And as a factual matter, Judge Naves found no chilling effect at the University of Colorado's faculty, students, anyone, as a result of the actions taken against Professor Churchill. The record is devoid of evidence on that point. If I could switch over to the quasi-judicial immunity argument, the case that Professor Churchill's counsel asked you to look at was the Clevenger case, and he suggests that this is dispositive of the issue. What I believe Clevenger is dispositive of is that there cannot be quasi-judicial immunity when there's not some post-procedure remedy that is judicial in nature. When the court, the Supreme Court and Clevenger looked at the case, ultimately their conclusion was, and forgive me one second while I find it, because I think the language of it is important. The court said, in sum, the members had no identification with the judicial processes of the kind and depth that have occasioned absolute immunity. And the reason that they made that determination, they laid out right before that, which is that there was no lawyers involved in the proceedings. There was no discovery. Most importantly, there was no cognizable burden of proof, and there was no recourse. I believe that, just like you asked the question, Judge Graham, this case is much, much closer to Butts versus Economou, in that particular case, the court's inquiry was, does this proceeding share enough characteristics with judicial proceedings to be entitled to immunity? And the things that they looked at in Butts were, was there a transcript created? Were there witnesses? Were they subject to cross-examination? Were there opening and closing statements? Was there a burden of proof? And most importantly, is there a right of judicial review? All of those things existed in Butts, and those were the characteristics that the court said, yes, this is quasi-judicial in nature, such that it shares enough of the characteristics that immunity should be granted. And if you go through and look at the factors that the court found to be important in Butts, all of them are fulfilled in this case.
Why would Rule 106 review be sufficient to satisfy those requirements?
Rule 106 review is sufficient in the same way that other forms of judicial review are sufficient in other cases, because under Rule 106, you have the ability to look at whether or not the action taken is contrary to law. That's one of the explicit standards under Rule 106. If Professor Churchill is saying that this is a First Amendment violation, he has the ability to demonstrate, based on the record that was generated, that the action taken against him was contrary to the First Amendment. It could have been reversed on that basis, had he used that mechanism. Under the Hewitt case, this court has specifically said that based on evidence of bias or prejudice in the record in a Rule 106 proceeding, that that is a sufficient basis for it to reverse the findings of a quasi-judicial entity. What Professor Churchill has essentially asked you to find is that the Colorado Supreme Court has created a meaningless form of review in Rule 106, and that has never been the case and will never be the case, because what Rule 106 does is it provides a forum by which the parties don't have to go and relitigate all the issues that they've already litigated. It creates essentially a form of appellate review. And just because it is subject to some standards of appellate review doesn't mean that it's a constitutionally inadequate remedy. And in fact, the type of remedy that was available in Butts was not to file a new case. It was to seek administrative review under the Administrative Procedure Act, a streamlined, condensed version of review that is constitutionally adequate there, as it is constitutionally adequate here.
Well, in Colorado, school board review is subject to 106 review.
Absolutely. And the case in which, and As far as whether or not this is quasi-judicial action, I don't believe that there's anything that distinguishes this case from the Witter case, which is the Colorado Supreme Court looking at a school board's termination of an employee and saying that is subject to Rule 106 review. They essentially looked at two factors in Witter to reach that determination. The first, they said, is, are you applying some type of legal standard to the conduct at issue? Are you looking at specific facts to see whether or not there's been a violation of policy? That is a judicial type of inquiry. It is not a policy-making inquiry. So first they said, yes, judicial type of question is being asked. Second, they asked, is this a judicial type of proceeding? And in Witter, they said, absolutely. You have lawyers representing clients in an adversarial type of hearing that is subject to a form of judicial review in the state of Colorado. With those predicates having been met, we find that this is quasi-judicial in nature. And because they were able to make that determination, the employee in that case was able to have his claim that he was unfairly terminated reviewed all the way up to the level of the Colorado Supreme Court. That mechanism was available to Professor Churchill. He chose not to exercise it. His failure to exercise the legal remedy available to him doesn't mean that that legal remedy is inadequate. The only question that springs from there is not just is this quasi-judicial, but is it of the type that it's such it should be able to garner immunity? And the question answered by Butts is, yes, it absolutely is, because it shares all of those characteristics of judicial process. Professor Churchill and his counsel have attempted to raise the issue of whether or not the fact that the regents are elected is sufficient to remove them from quasi-judicial immunity. We've cited several cases within our brief, the Brown case, the Tobin case, all of which stand for the proposition that even if you have an elected official, if that official is performing a judicial type of function, it doesn't matter that they are an elected official. The classic case is the one involving Governor Brown out of California, where they said when he reviews the type of parole decisions that are through the Department of Corrections, at that time, he is absolutely acting in a judicial capacity. He's applying legal standards. And even though he almost uniformly turns down these parole hearings and has said that he's going to be tough on crime, he's acting judicially at that point in time. And that decision is reviewable by the courts, so that he has abused his discretion acting in that type of judicial capacity, we as the courts can step in and fix it. And that is precisely the same situation that exists in this case. Finally, I wanted to address very quickly the arguments related to reinstatement. I believe that those are subject to the abuse of discretion standard as posited by Professor Churchill and his counsel. The evidence in this case was multiple on which Judge Nays made his rulings that Professor Churchill shouldn't be reinstated. The first was finding that it was inconsistent with the jury's verdict where it found no actual damages, which is an argument that is not as well established as some of the other ones, so that he then went and also looked at under traditional reinstatement type of analysis, is there a sufficient basis for him to reinstate? And importantly in this case found that returning Professor Churchill to the employment relationship would be inappropriate. And that inappropriateness was demonstrated by Professor Churchill's stated hostility to the employer and his unwillingness to conform his conduct to established standards of academic conduct. The university has the right to define the standards of conduct for its employees and its professors, and those prohibit acts like falsification, fabrication, and plagiarism, and returning Professor Churchill to that environment would cause harm not only to the university, but to the people who teach there, and the students who get their degrees from there, who would devalue their degrees, and make this an inappropriate case for reinstatement.
Thank you, Mr. Arar.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane?
Thank you. What is lost in Mr. O'Rourke's argument is the one plain fact that a jury has said that they are First Amendment violators. They are civil rights violators. That's what caused Ward Churchill to lose his job, not some academic standards that he didn't meet. But for the ability to take this to a jury, that finding never would have occurred. There would have been no remedy. Is a bad faith investigation required to launch a criminal case? Absolutely not. Couch and other cases, there's no case that says that. Every case we've cited in our brief says if a person of ordinary firmness would be chilled in their willingness to speak out on matters of public concern, that is an adverse employment action. And there was no finding, to my recollection, by Judge Naves that there was no chilling effect on campus at the University of Colorado. That would be an impossible thing to find, because how do you know who would have written something, who would have said something, but for the fact that they saw what happened to Churchill and they weren't about to put their necks on the chopping block? So you can't know what you know, it's like the death penalty. How many people are deterred from committing murder? You can't know these things.
You said that there was no evidence of it that was presented at trial.
Well, there was a chilling effect on, I mean, Ward Churchill suffered adverse consequences. Mr. O'Rourke says, well, that's not CU's fault, that people canceled speaking engagements and his reputation suffered. Well, yes, it is. The law is filled with proximate cause cases from Paul's Wrath on down through to present day that say if you can reasonably foresee that the consequences of your action are less than such, you're responsible for that. And they can reasonably see that launching a bad faith investigation against Professor Churchill would have consequences to Professor Churchill. And they did, and there was evidence to that effect. And that's all that is required to have an adverse employment action. Is there a bad faith investigation? There can be no doubt about it. Can regents be acting in a quasi-judicial capacity when they have personally, Regent Kerrigan says to the New York Times, we can fire Churchill, we just can't do it tomorrow. Regent Lucero is on national television talking about how they plan to get rid of Professor Churchill. The record below was filled with statements of the regent's intent. They go through this sham due process proceeding, and then they pretend to deliberate like judges. What are we going to do with Professor Churchill? Gee, I think we ought to fire him. What a shock. That was their verdict in January of 2005. And then in 2007 or 8, when they finally fired him, they reached the conclusion that was exactly predictable based on their prior statements. I'm out of time, but I'm asking that this court reverse, that you grant a new trial on a bad faith investigation, that you reverse the granting of quasi-judicial immunity, and you order reinstatement along with damages on that claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Thank you again, Mr. O'Rourke. Thank you both, counsel, for your brisk and excellent arguments. They were helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our 2:30 docket for today, and the bailiff may announce a recess.